This is the On Humans podcast with your host, Ilari Mäkelä. And I thought of beginning today's episode with a passage from Richard Dawkins's book, God Delusion. As the title suggests, this is a book mostly about or against religion. But towards the end of the book, Dawkins does also try to suggest something of an alternative view for the origins of things like kindness, empathy, and altruism. Dawkins's quite famous suggestion is that altruism, especially altruism towards strangers, is a kind of evolutionary mistake. Don't get him wrong, he doesn't think it's a bad thing. Quite the opposite, it's a, quote, precious, delicious mistake. But it is a mistake nevertheless. It stems from a rule of thumb that was designed for a different era. A different era where, even for the selfish gene, it made sense to feel altruism towards those around you. Where humans lived, quote, in small and stable bands like baboons. Dawkins continues to saying that in such ancestral times, quote, we had the opportunity to be altruistic only towards close kin and potential reciprocates. Nowadays, that restriction is no longer in place, but our rule of thumb persists, unquote. Now, this is a possible story at the face of it, and in some sense, it should be applauded, I think, because it just shows that even for hardcore evolutionists like Dawkins, there is nothing fundamentally incompatible with a genuine feeling of altruism and genetic evolution. But a more scientific question emerges, which is how accurate is this particular view about the human past? Did humans really live most of our ancestral past in small bands interacting not much with strangers, like a family sealed off from the rest of the world? Following hunter-gatherer experts, you quickly get the idea that this is not exactly the case. Hunter-gatherer groups tend to have more genetic diversity than this view would give credit for. But my guest today, Cecilia Padilla Iglesias, believes that the standard theory in anthropology hasn't gone nearly as far as it should away from this view. Indeed, she believes that both modern and prehistoric hunter-gatherers live in societies which are much bigger, broader, and more fluid, without sharp edges, than we normally think. We discussed both her academic work and her really excellent essay, which was recently published at Eon magazine. We also talk about her really fascinating work pulling data from archaeology and genetics to answer the really massive question that's haunting hunter-gatherer studies today, which is how similar are modern-day hunter-gatherers to those living in the deep human past. And I ask her what she thinks about the origins of things like sympathy on the one hand, and also xenophobia on the other hand. I mean, anyone reading Dawkins will not be surprised that humans can be nasty towards outsiders. Well, of course we can, because that was what was natural to do in the past. But Iglesias disagrees and gives her own take on the topic. I hope that you enjoy this conversation. If you do, I want to remind that On Humans is not running ads at the moment. So instead of me talking about vitamins or hiring platforms, I'm going to ask your patience for 30 seconds for me to remind that this is a work that takes a lot of time. It's work that I put out there for free, and you're absolutely welcome to enjoy it for free. If you do want to show some support, though, you can do that by, first of all, following the show, talking about it with friends, posting it on social media, and especially giving it a nice review on whatever podcast app you're using. If you also would like to support my work with a small monetary donation, you can do so at patreon.com/onhumans, where you can join the wonderful small club of people slowly growing who are actually chipping in a small amount, one cup of coffee, two cups of coffee, something like that every month to support my work. Thank you so much to everyone who's already supporting. And thank you to you if you are considering of joining now. So that's again, patreon.com/onhumans. But let's continue with the show. I bring to you Cecilia Padilla Iglesias. Cecilia Padilla Iglesias, welcome to On Humans.
Thank you very much. Thank you for having me.
I've had a few other hunter-gatherer experts on the show before, and I can't get enough of asking the same question. Can you describe a little bit your own experience? What has it been like to be living with people who practice hunting and gathering as their lifestyle?
I mean, I think you do a good thing by asking everybody the question so that everybody can give you a different experience, because I think that's the key of it that we have like not considered for a while. But in my experience, we were in the northern part of the Republic of Congo. And we were specifically working with people that live in mobile camps. We specifically actually chose the wet season, which is when people are most mobile, because it's when people are more dispersed, and they would live for the most of the time in like little camps. And by little, I mean with like between 5 and 10 huts in different parts of the forest. And they would clear a little area and camp there for like a couple of months around a resource that might be abundant during that season. And it was really interesting, I guess, from the perspective of someone from outside, to just engage in just like a completely different way of living, in which people wake up every day and they engage in whatever task they need in order to kind of end the day, and that's it somehow. Like in terms of subsistence, obviously there's things that are span much more planning and things like this. I'm not saying that people don't look far ahead, because in fact we saw a lot of like the, okay, we need to go to this place to get this resource, but in 3 days' time we have to go to a funeral in this other camp, so we need to plan the walk somehow. So for the most time that we wouldn't be in the forest, people would raise with the sun. And normally, then the older women specifically would start making a fire, and kids would start playing around them, and the adult people would go and engage in whatever foraging activity they considered that was the most suitable for the day. And we would actually not see people back at camp until the evening, and then when the sun was about to set, we would start seeing the women coming back, because they had to prepare to collect firewood so that they could start another fire for the night where they would cook. And then everybody would start, actually they would start sending children to share a little portion of whatever they had cooked with everybody else and distribute what had been cooked, at which point everybody would sit around the fires of their respective huts or others, and people would talk well into the night.
Okay. I think most of the people who don't know much of the details around hunters and gatherers might come from one or two extreme positions. One, the idea that their lives must be nasty, brutish, short, eternally at the verge of dying from hunger. And the other one, that they live in perhaps something of a original abundance, where the work days are relatively short. Their lives are relatively good, disease free in many in some ways, especially when it comes to infectious diseases that plague modern civilizations. I don't want to force you into too much of a simple dichotomy, but would you lean either way? Is there something that one of them gets more right than the other, or what do you think about this kind of question? Or is it how to imagine the kind of material well being of these people?
I mean, there are studies that have shown, for example, when these societies are forced to become sedentary, that you do get a higher prevalence of infectious disease, simply because you have people clustered together. I mean, we all know that sedentary societies are more densely populated than mobile societies. Because of that clustering, you get more infectious disease and higher mortality. However, like, I mean, when I'm telling you that I work in the Republic of Congo, I mean, this is a place that is in the middle of a rainforest, and rainforests are famous for having like mega high pathogen loads.
Yes, yes, exactly, yes.
So, I mean, I definitely think that there is variation on that. I think it's neither extreme. The problem is when you take people outside of their environment, but these hunter-gatherers have been living there for a really long time, so they're both culturally and biologically adapted to the conditions in which they live. So for sure, there are times that they have to work really hard. And I mean, we were surprised at how much these people can travel bare feet in the middle of the jungle. But of course, as well, there are times when perhaps they are relying on fish resources in the season where fishing is abundant, that they can enjoy most of the time in camp. And actually they take advantage of these seasons where there's relatively little work to do to organize like big rituals, like aggregations with other people from a much, much broader region and things like this. So I guess it's like, if you work in a corporate environment, you have January when everybody is making the business plan for the year, that you'll have a super high load of work.
Yeah.
I mean, I just don't think it's as simple as we try to put it.
Yeah. Is there something you miss about the lifestyle when you come back?
Certainly. I mean, there are many things that I miss. I miss the ability to be present in a place, because obviously, as a complete outsider, for most of the time that I was doing fieldwork. I was actually concerned about like surviving.
Yes. yes.
Like about being able to walk in the forest, about protecting myself from all the insects that would come in like huge swarms to chase me and Juliet, who was the master's student that came with me. And that can be like really exhausting, but at the same time, it's really liberating in the sense that your reality is exactly what you're living there and then. Obviously, we didn't have phone access or anything like this. So I really felt very engaged in my experience.
Okay. Well, thank you for sharing. Let's talk a little bit more about the scientific work then. You brought a really interesting piece for the Eon recently, which I read twice and really enjoyed. And I was trying to think of why I enjoyed it. So what were the kind of perhaps misconceptions, misunderstandings that I felt I might have had before reading it, or what kind of things it clarified for me? And one of the things that I think most easily I could detect was that it felt to be something of a challenge to the idea that hunter-gatherers live in tiny bands, which are then part of maybe like a mega band or something, which is maybe 150 people, but not more. So that these are very, very small societies that don't really interact beyond them, and that perhaps are even exceedingly small today because they have been pushed into marginal habitats by the expanding agriculturalists around them. And your work seemed to suggest that this is wrong on all accounts. Would that be a fair characterization of one strand of your argument?
Yeah. I mean, I think you've touched upon two main things here. I mean, and this was also something that I discussed with the Eon editors. This is why we start with the Mande Hunter Conference.
And this was in 1966 in Chicago, right? Kind of landmark yeah. moment in the modern hunter-gatherer yeah. studies, correct?
Yeah, and it was a landmark moment because it's when a lot of people that had lived amongst this amongst hunter-gatherer societies came together to look at commonalities and differences in different aspects, demography, social organization, mobility, all these variables. And in many of them, they did see that people lived in, I mean, this is before genetics, before we knew anything about this. So in many instances, you did see that people lived in camps like the one I described where I was in Congo, where you would have a few huts of a few people that looked like they were families. And then they would see these like occasional like aggregations between different camps, maybe to do a communal hunt, maybe to perform a little ritual and stuff.
And these aggregations would be like 100 people, 150 people or something?
Yeah. The Mande Hunter Conference was seen at the time as itself, it was a challenge to the previous notion that hunter-gatherers were these marginalized people. And on itself, it was attempted to represent a kind of, you know, hunter-gatherers are not these remnants of people that have been just simply pushed to places where nobody wants to live, but they are actually functioning societies. And that's why this collective of people joined together to do research with them. Now then, the problem is that these anthropologists had lived with hunter-gatherers for like maybe a few months. And of course, like what happened is that they looked at this way of living, and they were like, okay, this must represent a group of related individuals that live in these small camps that occasionally they join together with maybe some more distant relatives until you get to this magic number that has been used over and over again of like about 150 people as the maximum.
Yes, the Dunbar number, which in human brain size theoretically is suggested to say that this is the upper limit of a natural group size.
And even Dunbar's theory is based on this idea that for the most part of our history, when we were hunter-gatherers, we were living with a maximum world size of 150 people.
Yes.
And that's why our cognition supposedly have reached only till there.
That's interesting word that you used. The interesting word was world size. I love that. I've never heard that word before, but yeah, I think that captures it well. So the idea that these people live in a world that consists of 150 people and everybody else would be a complete stranger. Yes.
And that's the thing that has started to be challenged. The fact that, you know, it's not just that the same bands of 20 people come together every once in a while and that remain fixed. into the same groups of 150 people is actually that people are fluctuating from different camps, from different bands, and aggregating with different sets of individuals, to the point that when you try to map the upper limit of any person's or of a society, I mean, I don't think we have good estimates of this to this day, but it's definitely larger than anyone has attempted to demarcate somehow.
Yeah, I mean, you had some suggestions in the text about how, I mean, you compared humans to chimpanzees in here, where in chimpanzees, the number of role models that an average chimpanzee would learn things within their lifetime was predicted to be average 20. And this wasn't your study, but I think you quoted some other studies with Hadza and Aceh hunter-gatherers, Hadza in Tanzania and Aceh in modern-day Paraguay, that they would have around 300, so over 15 times more than chimpanzees, twice as much as Dunbar suggests that humans would naturally have.
Yes, I always talk about this study because on itself is a challenge to this traditional idea. But I want to point out that, I mean, I think it's a really neat study. It was from 2013, from a group of people that have been working for a long time amongst hunter-gatherers.
Yeah, this was Kim Hill and colleagues, right?
Yeah, yeah. And they took pictures. First of all, the study only included men.
Okay.
And secondly, they took pictures of people in different places, and then they presented the pictures to others, and they were like asked whether they knew or didn't know the person. But it wasn't exhaustive. It's not like they took pictures of every single Aceh that exists and asked every other Aceh whether they knew the person or not.
So is your interpretation that this is a nice pushback, but it there's no reason to believe that 300 is the exact correct number. It's just that it's clearly going to be bigger than what we used to think.
Exactly. I think it's a really important study, but I think it's definitely their estimation of the upper limit of their social worlds.
Yeah, yeah. So it's very common in especially people who kind of skim anthropology literature and then make grand theories about human evolution. It's being common to view this kind of really small scale societies as the norm. And on top of that, the idea has been often that in these very small scale societies, we have mostly people are family members, right? There's so many examples of this. I think Richard Dawkins would be the most famous, who suggests that one of the reasons that human emotions like sympathy would have evolved is because we just used to live with these tiny groups where everybody was genetically related, so it would make evolutionary sense to feel sympathy for them. And then nowadays, this quote-unquote misfires in places where we are suddenly meeting strangers. And I think I've known for a long time that this doesn't seem to be the case, because a lot of people, even within a small band, are not genetic relatives in hunter-gatherer groups. But I think, is it right that you're pushing even further back against this kind of thinking and suggesting that not only are people in a band not genetic relatives, but they're constantly in touch with this kind of much bigger web of bands that form a kind of almost like a fluid civilization or something?
Yeah, I mean, definitely. So, I mean, the nice thing about today's world in that sense is that we have really, like, we could have better evidence at a local level. And I'm working on this at the moment, but we know for sure basically a couple of things. The first one is that hunter-gatherers, and especially African hunter-gatherers, because we now know fairly certainly that, like, all humans eventually come from a population or several populations that lived in Africa. And we know that African hunter-gatherers are the most genetically diverse groups in the world.
Which means that they're closest to the root population, right?
Well, yes, but it also means that they've managed to maintain diversity. Mm. And if you were if you were constantly reproducing with closely related people and living in these small-scale worlds, you would actually draw genetic diversity from a very, very small population, and therefore you would start losing diversity just by chance and start accumulating the negative effects of inbreeding.
That is so interesting. That's a very interesting point, yeah.
And there's tons of research now at a super, super high resolution showing that obviously their hunter-gatherer groups are diverse, and there are people that have been badly affected by different aspects of the modern world, but that many groups show a history, not only that at present they are living in groups that are not closely related at all, but also that in the past, so that you can, because you can reconstruct the size of that source population that contributes to somebody's mating pool, that also in the past they were living in networks much larger than you would expect by the small size of their camps.
That's really striking.
And this we know. And actually research that is trying to contrast these studies with basically long-term, because now there's some people that have been working long-term in the same field sites with hunter-gatherer and drawn by hand, kind of like genealogical trees, with the caveat that you never know for sure whether someone is someone's child.
Yes.
They also find that even the people living at the camp level are not closely related at all.
Yes, yes.
You do have important connections between relatives that offer like key help, like maternal grandmothers famously, or siblings in particular points in their life. But that doesn't mean that everybody is related. In fact, you might have access to your close nuclear family and strong networks to a certain kind of your kin that is in another camp, that at the same time lives with the relatives of another group, that lives with the relatives of another group. And like that, you keep expanding.
And I just find it fascinating that we can do all of these things with genome. Haven't quite finished David Reich's book, who Are We and Where Do We Come From, on ancient genetics, but it's a field that is just constantly blowing my mind. But I had not seen anything as detailed about hunter-gatherer genomic work than actually when I read your article, and it was really striking. Because just with a little bit of context here, I think that there's a lot of interest that people have in hunter-gatherers as a possible model of what is it like for humans to live on wild foods, and then we could learn something about what was it like to be human in the deep past, in the Paleolithic, when everybody lived from wild foods. But of course, the problem is that we don't know if the people today resemble the groups in the past, because they're also modern people. And this was one of the first times when I saw a serious attempt of using modern day groups together with these tools like archaeology and genetics to get a really kind of take this problem seriously. And it was, I was really struck by the paper.
Yeah, I mean, there's been a revolution in the field of genetics, from studying kind of like broad continental patterns of things happening, to really use this as a tool to understand the social and the family lives of both present and ancient peoples and extinct things like Neanderthals or other species. And that really you can get at the family life and the reproductive behavior of these people through genetics.
I would like to quickly introduce what was the question you were trying to address, and how, without getting too deep into the genetics and paleo climatology, what would be like a short kind of a common sense explanation of why you are interested in this paper, and how did you proceed, and what did you find? Because this was one of the most interesting papers I've read in modern hunter-gatherer studies.
So basically, actually, we recently wrote with one of my very close friends an article about how hunter-gatherers had contributed, how genetics research with hunter-gatherers had contributed to different aspects of our understanding of what it means to be human. And we separated this contribution to population history to also contribution to what we think about the evolution of human social organization and reproductive behavior. And especially with ancient genetics, like if you see a group of people that are buried together or that are within the same area, you can start to look at the pedigree of these people from a genetic perspective. So one thing that has been repeatedly found out is that in, for example, Neanderthal societies, you see that people that are buried together tend to be very closely related. So this prediction that we make of like people living in sort of close-knit groups, but that when you look at any Paleolithic burial of Homo sapiens, it's always surprising how distantly related people that are buried together. And archaeologically, we have the context for these people. So it looks like it would be like your usual like small camp of hunter-gatherers. And then when you look at the people's remains, they are always distant relatives. They have a genetic diversity that is comparable to these high levels of genetic diversity that we observe in hunter-gatherers today.
Interesting. And so this is also something that could distinguish sapiens from Neanderthal humans.
I think people have gone as far as arguing that hunter-gatherers, Homo sapiens hunter-gatherers, one of the reasons why they might have been able to adapt to some of the vast, like large environmental changes throughout human evolution, but also their ability to expand. I mean, there's no other species in the world that lives in every single continent of the planet with so little differences between one another. And that one of the reasons why Homo sapiens might have been able to do that and non-Neanderthals is that by cultivating these high genetic diversity, mainly through mobility, but through keeping these very large reproductive networks, they would have been able to adapt fast to this because they had large reservoirs of genetic diversity.
And besides genetics, like I don't want someone to listen to think that all we're saying here is that, well, sapiens, humans move a lot, they maintain a lot of genetic diversity, so maybe they're less inbred than Neanderthals, that's how they win them. But I think you're saying something more, is that this is also culturally super important because these kind of massive distances that these hunter-gatherer groups can travel and meet each other in. I mean, I earlier used kind of tongue-in-cheek the word fluid civilization. I don't know if you have your own favorite term for this, but the idea that this ends up being a big reason how we learn so much is that if these hunter-gatherer groups constantly keep meeting new ones, merging, fissioning, that there's a lot of cultural knowledge that keeps flowing and allowing people to maintain their technologies there, whatever ways that they have been adapted to live, for example, in the rainforest. Do I get that one right? And do you want to elaborate on that, if yes, or correct me if I'm wrong?
No, I think you're absolutely right. I mean, one of the key defining features of humans is that we don't only adapt genetically. In fact, we adapt culturally. For adapting culturally is way faster. You don't need to wait for people to reproduce and that as a source of introducing variation that arises at random, but that you can actually create cultural variants that tools from tools to knowledge to everything in the world is cultural. And in fact, there's also this very nice thing about culture that the moment that something is either culturally or biologically important, let's say in this case, mobility, you can also create cultural values that promote mobility and where mobility is sort of well regarded socially, in which case it becomes even more important because we all need to be liked by our groups and accepted. And therefore, if mobility becomes social value, you're even more incentivized to do so. And actually, for example, early anthropologists from the 50s working in the Congo Basin, really close to where I was as well, were saying that actually people like teenagers, before they were turning to adulthood, it was expected of them that they would do like an 800 kilometer journey and return.
Whoa.
As part of like, you're becoming an adult now.
800 kilometers, that's a lot. That's almost like, that's a long way. Is that like London to Edinburgh or something? I'm not sure. That's a long way. Yeah. Okay. But so can I ask you then on a bit of a speculative note? I mean, the kind of view that is certainly not only the view of Richard Dawkins. I just think that because he's such a prolific author and such a well-known figure, we can use him as a kind of one of these people who have in his writings taken this kind of very, very tiny, genetically closely related small-scale human society as a model of how human emotions, social emotions, moral emotions would have evolved. I think that the two things that would be easy to derive from this idea that we live in these tiny, tiny groups that don't really meet others is that it's very easy to explain feelings like sympathy because they were the most natural thing to feel because everybody was genetic kin. On the other hand, it would also be very natural to think that we are naturally xenophobic, very, very averse to strangers. What do you think about these speculative questions about the origins of the moral emotions if we move away from this model that people like Dawkins have used?
I mean, there's extensive research in human behavioral ecology about the fact that humans care about kin. I mean, that kin, that preferential sharing or it is a thing that kind of tends to happen across every society. But I think we have so much extensive evidence that people need non-kin individuals, that these people serve key roles in assisting households in times of need, in sharing information from non-local sources. In other words, that people have relied in non-kin.
Not just family, but also friends.
Yeah. And my PhD supervisor, Andrea, did a very neat study monitoring the social networks of two hunter-gatherer groups, one in Congo, one in the Philippines. And she was showing that from the age of three, people were spending most of the time with unrelated individuals, and that they were key, and that as people grew up in terms of knowledge transmission, food transmission, that these non-kin ties were key resource channels between different households and also between different camps. So I don't think we can look at an evolution of human cognition of any form that has evolved in purely kin-based communities. Like, of course, we have evolved to attend to our kin, but definitely not exclusively.
So what do you think about this point of xenophobia and meeting with strangers then? Because this is something which is so common to hear, that we were used to living in these small groups. So of course, you know, if you meet someone different, that's like the most natural thing for us to be a bit averse or scared or something. How much does this extremely mobile, you know, fluid way of life, where you have these massive networks maintaining genetic diversity, how much does that challenge these ideas, or how does it make you think about the origins of themes like xenophobia?
I just think that xenophobia just comes from a completely different place. I mean, if we look at aversion to strangers, for example, and we compare ourselves to any of our grade A relatives, I think we can establish that these are our closest living relatives. And I read a few years ago a book called The Human Swarm. It talks about the emergence of large-scale societies in humans, and it has a passage, I can't remember where the author is saying how, look at the sort of routine situation where we enter a cafe and we order a cappuccino and we're there at the counter waiting for the waiter or waitress to serve our cappuccino. We don't know anybody in this coffee shop. We don't know the person that's making our coffee. And we are completely relaxed whilst waiting for our coffee to be done. If you put any of our great ape relatives in that situation, they would go absolutely crazy.
So I think that's a wonderful example. But the pushback, of course, that people might have is that, yes, but this is all because of our modern norms around market economies, etc. And it's what you're saying is that, no, this is not just a modern invention of market economies, this kind of ease with strangers in a coffee shop, but this is something that you would witness in the rainforest equally well as in the streets of a European city.
Yeah, I definitely think so. I mean, these are the same people that then argue that we've evolved in a Paleolithic environment. They could not then say that then we've unevolved since we have coffee shops and therefore that's why our cognition is different. But
yes.
I do think that as humans, we are very, we rely on social information for our ability to judge whether we have to be scared of strangers or not. And this definitely is the case also in hunter-gatherer societies. Like if I tell you tomorrow, my friend is going to come to visit, please be nice to them. Like they are a super nice person. Like when my friend arrives, you're going to be, or if instead of my friend, I'm like, oh, tomorrow this group of backpackers that are coming, that I know them really well, are going to pass by your camp. They're super nice, you know, say hi. You're not going to be scared. If I tell you this is a group of horrible people, you might be more weary. So I think, and then we get into bigger topics such as language and the role that this might have. But I do think a lot of what we do as humans is to exchange social information precisely about what to make of strangers that we have never met, but that we might meet.
Well, by the way, can I ask on that point, I mentioned earlier that one of the things that comes out from some of your work is also the idea that the habitats that, for example, the Bayaka people that you live with, for example, that they are not just pushed into marginal habitats. And that actually when you look at genetics and archaeological and linguistic work, it seems that these, what you call Central African hunter-gatherers, which spread quite a big distance in the rainforest from East to West Africa, that they come from the same source population, they maintain a lot of genetic diversity, and now I'm not exactly sure how to frame this. Are you saying that actually the populations now are not dramatically diminished from what we predict them to have been 30,000 years ago, 50,000 years ago, or something? That they're actually in some sense doing just fine at the moment. They haven't, their life haven't been massively disturbed by agriculture around them, or how exactly should I read the conclusion from the paper where you modeled the past population sizes and movements of these people?
So I mean, the striking thing about Central Africa and in general the Congo Basin is because across fields, like in archaeology, in ancient genetics, in paleoanthropology, it has completely been removed from studies of human evolution, from the sort of old stuff, from people that work with fossils or people that work with material culture. This is because it's a really challenging region to work with. Like, the soil preserves material terribly. It almost has no preservation for DNA. Fossils are also, the soil is very acidic.
The rainforest destroys everything. So, yes.
Yeah. And also the political situation in the region has not been the most peaceful. So people had just not found or not been able to find old stuff. So they had just kind of like ignored it. But then it's the heart of Africa. I mean, if we're talking about population interconnectivity, it's where all the other regions can be connected from. And then it was really striking because we also have the largest group of people that live from hunting and gathering. I mean, 20 or so groups that can add up to 1 million people, but we didn't really know. And they are living there. And people have kind of dodged this fact for a while by saying, I mean, there was this massive expansion of farmers in starting from Central Africa, the Bantu speakers. And now in most African regions, they speak Bantu languages. So it was an unprecedented human expansion. And also, like, you know, the rainforests are super challenging habitats. Carbohydrate sources are very scarce. So there was this hypothesis put forward that actually the people that live from hunting and gathering there must have been some kind of marginalized people that were relegated to the forest, maybe some lower caste of these farmer groups or something that were relegated to the forest when these expansions happened, and that kind of that exchange in some kind of unequal trade relationships with these farmers in order to survive.
So not good models in any sense of the human past.
Exactly. But the thing is, you know, the archaeological evidence that we have, the one that we could look at by the time I started my PhD, now we've compiled really much larger and comprehensive databases. But there are some sites in Central Africa associated with hunter-gatherers for a really long time. There are some human remains. And in 2020, the first ancient genomes of from Cameroon were published, and they basically showed that contemporary Central African hunter-gatherers, like the ones that I was working with, that they showed you, when you reconstruct sort of the human phylogeny from them, that they showed some of the deepest lineages out of all humans. So suggesting that at least population-wise, we were talking about people that were distinct from these Bantu farmers for a long time.
And who had been maintaining their culture, their community, some kind of an unbroken fashion for tens of thousands of years, right?
Yeah, and I guess the question that I wanted to ask for that paper of the paleo environment thing, basically we build a model relating where people live now to the environments that they occupy, and we use really like climatic models from the past, so climatic reconstructions from the past, and we extrapolated our model, and we were like, okay, if people have been adapted to these conditions for a while, would they have been able to maintain themselves and to maintain large populations throughout history considering these changes in the environment? And we saw that yes, and that actually the places where our model looking at what conditions would have favored hunter-gatherer occupation over time, that are places that our model pointed at as favorable, were also the places where we were most likely to find archaeological remains associated with hunter-gatherer context. So pointing at the fact that not only these populations had remained distinct for a really long time, but they had exploited the same kind of ecological niche for the whole time.
Yeah, I think if I understood correctly from your paper, you almost see in the African genome, you almost see this massive split. So first you have this split between the San people, so the what are sometimes called the Bushmen of the Kalahari Desert. I don't think that's a very much appreciated term nowadays, but people like the Juhansi that they are the deepest lineage that has split from everyone else pretty much in the human story. And then something like, was it 50,000? That was like 90,000 years ago you modeled. And then around 50,000 years ago, you have a split from the Central African hunter-gatherer, split from who then later become, for example, these Bantu-speaking agriculturalists. Do I remember those facts, or did I understand those facts right?
I mean, I want to raise caution on our estimate, on genetic estimates of population splits, because the confidence intervals are huge. But we definitely see that there is a very, very deep branching close to the origin of what we consider Homo sapiens per se, of a lineage that then would lead to the San, including the Juhuansi that you mentioned. That there's another deep split that would lead eventually to all the hunter gatherers in Central Africa. So that's the Congo Basin. We also see that the Central African hunter gatherers themselves would have split also quite a long time ago. But that these groups, and actually this is something that genetics can also tell us, that because genetics can tell us whether these splits have been sort of what we would say clean splits, which is two populations split and never interact again, or whether they have involved subsequent episodes of migration. And we do see actually these subsequent episodes of migration between all the African lineages. So we see very deep splits and again, subsequent episodes of connectivity.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, one important thing, which relates a little bit to xenophobia, because I'm trying to imagine what is this life like. Are there like different groups speaking different languages that are only interacting with? So are there kind of like two different fluid civilizations that live in the same area, or is it just one mega fluid civilization in one area? Am I right that the evidence points maybe more to the latter? So for example, the Eastern and the Western Central African hunter-gatherers are very, very far apart, speak completely different languages, but you found that they, for example, share the same words for musical instruments. So there's been clearly these cultural links and sharing of things like music.
I mean, I think it's more of a gradient thing. I think it's like colors. When we look at the difference between blue and green, it's just that it varies gradually up to the point that you would categorize one as blue and one as green. And this is a big debate also in anthropology, the extent to which competition or clearly defined cultural groups have played a part in human evolution. And at least when talking about the kind of societies that I have worked on, I honestly don't think there is such a clearly defined boundary. Like, we were looking at dialect groups and they are not that clearly defined. You have a lot of multilingual people, and this is a norm also in many parts of the world. So I definitely think it's more of a, you know, if you live far away, you are inevitably less close to people that are closer to you. Or if you, exploit a certain type of resources, you might, which is also a finding that we found out, you might specialize in certain types of toolkits and be more interested in certain kinds of cultural activities. And by virtue of that, engage with a different subset of people. But I don't think they would regard it as we are the Western, you are the Eastern, and we can't peacefully interact. Like, I would find that very strange.
Well, that leads into the last thing that I really want to ask, which is that there are people who would say that absolutely so. And indeed, what we get, we only when we settle down due to agriculture or some other reasons, only then you start seeing these things like very clearly defined cultural groups, which can have very antagonistic warlike relationship with each other. You get also all sorts of other problems, inequalities between ranks, between sexes, etc. And therefore, in the words of Jared Diamond, agriculture or other reasons to settle down, he might add, were the worst mistake in the history of human race. What do you think about that point then? Because everything we've spoken so far, I think, only feeds into the part of my my mind that does question the merits of settling down.
I mean, I think settling out, again, from an ecological perspective, it's a strategy. And I think that's how we should conceive it. I mean, I think it pays off under certain conditions, and as the conditions change, it may or may not pay off.
But does it pay off in terms of population size that then can then start migrating and populating the world while perhaps having less good of a quality of life? So when you say pay off, I of course it pays off in terms of the sheer number of people that you can sustain. But I think what Diamond would be pointing at is that it might have been something that reduces quality of life in many ways and leads into a lot of negative consequences.
I mean, I think it's a double-edged sword. Again, one would have to be in the, and I think this is why it's relevant to refer to early studies of, now we know a lot archaeologically, there's a lot of people interested on the origins of farming. And what we see is that in many parts around the world that were regarded as kind of these homes to domestication, there is evidence for this kind of like testing agriculture of like seasonally engaging with a bit of cultivation. And actually the hunter-gatherers that I've been working with in Congo also seasonally like cultivate yams and whatever, and which you could consider as farming.
Yes, it's not one mistake. It's not that should we stay as mobile hunter-gatherers or should we settle down and have a civilization?
So I think, sure, eventually you become more and more settled. In many cases, it led to stuff like increased infectious disease and things like that. But we don't know in those instances what would have been the alternative. Like, I think, you know, that's what looking at it as a strategy, I think it's helpful, perhaps.
Very good. As a final question that I ask all guests, I would want to ask, how has all this research and everything we've talked about shaped your outlook on humanity?
I don't know, but what I definitely think it has shaped is my vision that humans have been and are way more diverse than we often like to think. So when we look at political systems, at economic systems, at social organization, we often think that the way we live is kind of the way it is because it's the one that worked. We have this kind of like selection bias, whilst I think looking at other societies and how in the past and present makes you aware that actually way more alternatives and are possible than the ones that we often get presented with.
Cecilia Padilla Iglesias, thank you so much for your really, really interesting writings, your wonderful work and your time today.
Thank you so much.
So that was it for today. Thank you for sticking with us until the very end. If you enjoyed this episode, you might want to check also episode 14 with Vivek Venkatraman about the way that modern hunter-gatherers sometimes are and sometimes are not good models of the deep past. If you enjoyed this and other conversations on the On Humans podcast, please also do consider showing some support. You can follow the show on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, wherever you get your shows. Leave a nice review if you think that the work deserves it. And if you do want to show some serious support, you can head to patreon.com/onhumans and pledge a small sum every month. Thank you so much for considering. And until next time, take care.